This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
Biosimilar use is limited in some healthcare systems because biosimilars are not well understood by many healthcare professionals and patients. The knowledge gap is exacerbated by disparagement of biosimilars and dissemination of misinformation, whether intentional or otherwise. These are the opening words of an article titled "The Importance of Countering Biosimilar Disparagement and Misinformation," published in 2020 in the research journal BioDrugs. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor-in-chief of DIA Global Forum. Today, I am joined by a co-author of this article, Dr. Hillel Cohen, whose leadership and expertise in the field of biosimilars is widely recognized. As the executive director of scientific affairs in the Sandoz division of Novartis, Dr. Cohen focuses on science policy related to biosimilar development. He also serves as a Sandoz representative to the education committee of the U.S. Biosimilars Council. In 2016, he was one of the industry representatives who helped negotiate reauthorization of the Biosimilars User Fee Act with the FDA. Dr. Cohen also chaired the session titled "Prescriber and Patient Confidence with Biosimilar Use" at DIA's Biosimilars Conference 2020. Dr. Cohen, thank you for joining us today and welcome.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to speak to you and to your audience.
Before we discuss your very interesting article, could we set the stage for a little bit? Today, it's 10 years, more or less, after passage of the U.S. Biologics Price Competition and Innovation Act, and 5 years after the first biosimilar was made available on the U.S. market. So at this point in time, how would you characterize the state of biosimilars? And specifically, what are some of the key lessons we've learned about improving biosimilar adoption and uptake?
It's a pleasure to see the 10-year anniversary and the 5 years since the first biosimilar, filgrastim SNDC. And I'm glad to say that I had a small role in helping bring that to the U.S. market and to patients. As lower-cost treatment options, biosimilars have really helped address rising costs within the U.S. healthcare system, hospitals, and patient care. For example, the availability of biosimilar filgrastim generated approximately $1.2 billion in savings to the U.S. healthcare system from 2016 to early 2020. However, as you've noticed, there are still barriers, various barriers that continue to inhibit biosimilars from realizing their full potential, driven by market obstacles, formulary challenges, and misinformation campaigns. Now, in recent years, we've seen physician and stakeholder education is key to helping overcome some of these challenges. As biosimilars receive FDA approval and more become available to patients, we're beginning to see a greater understanding and appreciation for these medicines as lowest cost options. It's important that we continue to build momentum by supporting a legal, regulatory, and market environment that helps realize the full savings that biosimilars can provide.
So this suggests that more work needs to be done and that more progress needs to be made?
There's no question that over time, physicians have become more knowledgeable and more comfortable with biosimilars. There's still a ways to go. Patients tend to become more knowledgeable about biosimilars as it becomes immediately relevant to them, sort of a just-in-time concept. And we're seeing that certainly the last 5 years, knowledge levels have been increasing, acceptance levels have been increasing over time, but still there's a ways to go. There's still concepts that are different for physicians and that have to be explained. In this recent biosimilars article that you mentioned, I did mention 5 or 6 concepts that are somewhat challenging for physicians and their patients to understand. The variability of products. All biologics have variability. Physicians didn't know that. They thought that when they're giving a biologic, it's the same from one lot to the next. That's actually not the case. There is inherent variability in biologics. We just have to explain that to people. The term abbreviated licensure pathway for biosimilars. Some people can mean, oh, it's not quite as rigorous. That's actually not the case. For biosimilars, it's extremely rigorous, but the rigor is in different places than originators. There's much, much more emphasis on analytics and manufacturing controls. Manufacturing controls constant for all, but certainly analytical characterizations and head-to-head comparisons of the reference product and the biosimilar are also conducted. So it's not abbreviated in the sense of the totality of what's being done, but it's abbreviated in the fact that there's fewer phase 3 clinical safety and efficacy studies.
This is not generally appreciated by physicians, as you mentioned.
No. Physicians are trained, and as they should be, to look for safety and efficacy studies. Another thing is totality of evidence. It's an important term for biosimilars. And what that means is that you look at the entire package, the analytical data. That means chemical comparisons. That means functional comparisons. Then you look at the pharmacokinetic comparisons of the originator biologic. All this head-to-head comparisons within the tight limits that are established. And if necessary, you may need to do a safety and efficacy confirmation study, not necessarily a end-all be-all phase 3 study as is done for the originator. But it really is confirmation that the totality of evidence and the high similarity you saw in the analytics and the similarity of the PK that carries through. So this is a new concept. Clinical data, as you mentioned, is also different. Clinical data requirements are different for biosimilars, and the goals of those clinical trials are different. The concept of extrapolation, we've used extrapolation for years as a regulatory concept. But to extrapolate indications, well, one physician said, you know, it wasn't studied in my particular indication for which I prescribe for my patients. But the reality is we choose the indications to be studied in the clinical trials for a reason. They're the most sensitive studies, and they have the same mechanism of action. So we're not really choosing something willy-nilly. There's really a good reason why we're extrapolating. And I even mentioned that the wording of legislation can be confusing at times. That's really getting into the weeds. But that's a simple fact, that the wording of legislation is written for regulators. It's not necessarily written to be easily understood by the lay people. All of these concepts together are challenging and new, and they can all be explained, but they are new.
Let me get to a second question that's kind of related concerning a different constituency, and that is, how do hospital networks and pharmacy networks play in supporting efforts to improve biosimilar uptake? What is their role?
That's actually a very important question. We have to appreciate that rapid biosimilar uptake is unlikely to happen on its own. Successful biosimilar adoption requires buy-in and continued support from key decision makers, such as the pharmacy and therapeutic committees, the P&T committees. Hospital and pharmacy networks can also help by designating a biosimilar champion. This would be a person or persons who'd be responsible for conveying potential benefits of biosimilars to stakeholders throughout their healthcare system. It's also important, and here's an interesting point, to the extent possible, to structure formulas so they do not unintentionally inhibit biosimilars. Now, of course, the impact of biosimilar savings will vary depending on delivery system and account. Pharmacy teams must evaluate the full financial benefit of biosimilars across these different environments to develop an ideal incentive plans, incentive structures that support more widespread use in their specific system. Hospital and pharmacy networks can also support physician and patient education and ensure that prescribers are aware of the latest clinical data showing biosimilars are a safe and effective lower cost option. They also need to equip physicians with tools to inform their patients of how starting or switching to biosimilar can support their disease journey.
So far we've talked about how to distribute and disseminate correct information and proper education to those that need it. So let me turn now to your article, which really was the first ever peer-reviewed article examining the impact of biosimilar misinformation and disparagement. To start out, could you give us a sense of the types of misinformation and disparagement that have been observed and that you described in the article? And then we'll get to what can be done about it.
Let me give you a broad overview of the whole concept and why it's important. And then I'll dive deep into the article itself, if you don't mind.
Okay.
We have to acknowledge that disparagement of biosimilars and misinformation has a very real potential to slow adoption of biosimilars, diminishing opportunities to increase patient access and to help generate healthcare savings. This impact should not be underestimated. Now, a recent analysis showed that a more competitive biosimilars market could save up to $7 billion annually. That's with a B. A substantial increase from the annual cost savings we're seeing now of around $240 million. Now, to counteract efforts to foster fear of biosimilars through targeted misinformation, FDA has taken steps to ensure that physicians and their patients have clear and accurate information about effectiveness and safety of biosimilars. This includes patient and provider education materials such as infographics, webinar presentations, actually, and even direct outreach to these stakeholder groups. Industry has played a role as well by providing credible, fact-based education materials that the health systems can then circulate to their patient teams, the medical teams, and even the finance teams. Now, as far as explicit examples.
Yes, please.
I've identified 5 different types of examples. We have statements about biosimilar policy that are just factually incorrect. There's also misleading information where the information is correct, but provided out of context. We can have incomplete information, where only a partial or limited set of facts are provided. And then there's what I call creation of a false narrative, especially in scientific and medical literature, that provides a set of references to support incorrect conclusions. As a scientist, that bothers me. And then there's negative framing of factual statements to create negative perceptions. So all in all, when I took a look back in the last several years at the different types of disparagement information, it's not one size fits all. It's actually of different types.
Thank you. So you've mentioned how misinformation and disparagement can impact and do impact, in your opinion, the adoption of biosimilars in the U.S. What solutions are at hand or should be developed?
I identified in this article a couple of steps that can be taken. The first, as we mentioned, you have to have clear and unbiased scientific messaging. Hopefully, truth will always win out, although it may take time, and I expect it will take time. As we mentioned before, patients become interested in biosimilars when it becomes relevant to them. Likewise, physicians become more interested in biosimilars when it becomes relevant to their specialties. It's really not just a U.S. concern. We see it happening in Europe. We happen to see it in Latin America and other regions of the world as well. We recommend that when the public encounters these things, they should report it to the relevant authorities, the Federal Trade Commission. In the FDA, there's an Office of Prescription Drug Promotion that looks at things of this nature. OPDP and the FTC will look at it and see whether it really rises to the level of disparagement information, and then they'll take whatever steps they believe are relevant. It's also important that in the scientific literature, that reviewers and editors of scientific journals and trade publications have responsibility to critically review articles to make sure that they're truthful and balanced. We've seen these false narratives when articles make statements that are misleading or incorrect, and then they can be cited as literature references. We have to be careful in the literature as well.
Are you saying that some scientific journals, peer-reviewed journals, have published articles that contained, in your opinion, misinformation and disparagement, even though they were peer-reviewed articles in presumably reputable journals?
Yes. In fact, there are a couple quoted in my publication. I gave a couple of examples.
Okay.
There are a few other things that we could do as well. Education. Now, there's a lot of education materials already out there. Besides just the FDA, patient advocacy groups are beginning to create this information, and peer-to-peer communication is always helpful. A lot of patients first go to Dr. Google for their first source of information, and we want to make sure that the information that they receive is accurate and truthful. We recommend biosimilar education in professional schools, medical schools, nursing schools, pharmacy schools. And the FDA has just announced that they are undertaking a 2-year effort to try and survey what's available and help develop a model curriculum for these professional schools. That would be very useful. We also think that this information should be made available in easy to understand wording, not necessarily regulatory terminology, easy to understand wording, and in formats that are easily accessible. You can find it easily on the internet. Infographics are also very useful instead of a long, dense, wordy paper. And finally, to address one of the points I mentioned about negative framing, you want to talk about positive framing. Positive frame about the quality of the products and about their performance. Instead of saying highly similar means not exactly the same, you want to say highly similar to the point where patients can expect the same type of clinical outcomes. The way that we word our explanations about biosimilars can be very helpful. There's actually something called the nocebo effect. People are familiar with the placebo effect, but the reverse is also true. If you expect a worse outcome, you may actually see that. There have been a few, not many, but a few studies with biosimilars where patients were forced to go on a biosimilar without any good explanations, because we believe that the physician should definitely be part of the process. Physicians, nurses, pharmacists, the healthcare system should clearly explain to patients what biosimilars are and why they're being given biosimilars instead of getting something by a letter. Patients can go years to find just the right treatment option for them, and to be told they had to switch, that can be very stressful. So you really should provide patients good explanation of what it is. And you have to tell people that the quality is the same. Just because it's less expensive doesn't mean it's of lower quality. The FDA has exact same quality standards for biosimilars as they do for the originators. So point number one for patients, you're getting a quality product. Point number two is that you really should have the same benefits, and you'll be actually can have the same side effects as that of the originator. You are not being switched to a new medication. You're being kept on the same medication that's being made by a different manufacturer.
Looking to the future, you might agree that we can expect more and more biosimilars to arrive on the market, the world markets, in the coming years. So as they become available, you've already mentioned several measures that can be undertaken to promote biosimilars use, but how can we better prepare to address the issues you've identified, the misinformation, disparagement, low adoption, et cetera, in the future, in addition to the measures that you've already mentioned?
Yeah, I think there are. We've talked about increasing clinician education. We also need to support policies that increase biosimilar adoption and to help create a more balanced and competitive marketplace. I can give a couple of examples. It could include reducing administrative burdens for patients and providers by removing redundant prior authorization requirements for a biosimilar when one was granted for the reference biologic. That makes no sense, but it does exist in some settings. We could also provide temporary add-on payment in Medicare Part B to incentivize healthcare providers to prescribe biosimilars. Another possibility is we could reduce or eliminate the patient's cost sharing in Medicare Parts B and D when using lower cost biosimilars over the more expensive reference products. So there are policy initiatives that can be undertaken that I think would help speed adoption and access to biosimilars in the U.S.
And finally, Dr. Cohen, what excites you the most about the future of biosimilars in the U.S. or indeed globally? So what is exciting about the future?
I want to say at the outset, I'm really thrilled to be working in the area of biosimilars. I've been doing it for many years. It's gone from a development process to something that we had to convince people, and now we're definitely in an upward swing. Biosimilar adoption is definitely increasing. Oncology biosimilars have done very well. Immune modulating biosimilars adoption is ongoing, but perhaps at a lower rate. But there's no question we're on an upward swing. As more biosimilars enter the U.S. market, patients treated with biologic medicines will have access to a broader set of more affordable treatment options. Here's an interesting little tidbit. An estimated additional 1.2 million U.S. patients can gain access to biologics by 2025 as a result of increasing biosimilar availability. So it's not just cost savings, it's also increased access. We've seen that in numerous healthcare systems. More and more patients are getting treated with biologics when biosimilars become available. Additionally, biosimilar cost-saving potentials are starting to gain the attention of state employers, retirement systems, and self-insured employers looking to cut costs. In the U.S., the ERISA Industry Committee just released a study examining the impact of biosimilars on health plans. Their results suggested that large U.S. employers could have saved an average of $1.5 million in 2018 by expanding coverage for just two biosimilars that they were examined. And importantly, we always talk about the benefit to patients. Their employees would have individually spent hundreds of dollars less each year. A lot of people are saying that the savings for biosimilars are going primarily to those of the insurance companies. And that's the rebate traps and things like that. That's really true. So it's a challenge in the world of biosimilars in general to make sure that patients see this. In fact, there are physicians out there who says, I will give my patients biosimilars when I can see that they benefit. I don't want the benefits to go to the healthcare system or to the insurance companies. I can understand that. And that's inherent in the U.S. healthcare system. But realistically, if the healthcare system saves money, theoretically, the premiums will go down. Now, looking into the future, we see a growing acceptance of the concept of tailored biosimilar clinical development in which phase 3 style efficacy studies would not be routinely required. They'd be required on an as-needed basis, not for every single product if you have extensive analytical and PK and immunogenicity data from other sources. You can't get away from the need for a large base of data. But the question then becomes, do we always need to have a phase 3 style efficacy study? Now, if this concept is accepted, it has potential to accelerate future biosimilar development. And of course, that would allow patients to access the benefit of these therapies more quickly. So I think the future is very bright. We're just at the beginning of the world of biosimilars.
When it comes to small molecules, we know that in the U.S., at least 70% or more of prescription small molecules are generics these days. You see a day where a similar percent, high percentage of biologics prescriptions will be for biosimilars rather than innovator biologics. Are we heading in that direction?
We're heading in that direction. I don't know if we're going to get up to 85, 90%. You have to realize two things. There's always going to be a need for originated biologics because biosimilars are only available after a set period of time when they can enter the market. If we're talking about those biological which biosimilars exist, what we're asking is that they compete on a level playing field, that we have a sustainable market. And once that's done, I think there will be a substantial portion of biosimilars. It is possible, it can happen. I think it's going to be on a product by product basis, but there's no question that there is going to be competition, and competition is always good.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen. Those are all my questions for today. Appreciate your insights, the huge experience in the space, and the real education for me and for our listeners. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Really a pleasure speaking to you and to your audience.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.